And good morning, and welcome to the Drive Time edition of Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet, and I'm here in the studio with Patty Fink. Have you heard from Laurent this morning?
He's not coming.
Oh, he's not coming this morning. Okay, okay. He isn't able to come this morning. He has a two-year-old. And so, 2 year-olds on Wednesday morning is not very good.
It decreases his odds on many things.
It certainly does. It certainly does. We have a guest in the studio today. It is Roger Waddell. Roger is the executive director of the Legal Hospice of Texas. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And Legal Hospice of Texas does lots of for-profit, expensive suing major corporations.
That's exactly who we are and what we do. We represent only the wealthy people who really have all the access to justice.
And that's who we usually talk about and defend here on KNON. So welcome.
We're one of those oddities, actually. When I introduce our agency, I say we're an oxymoron. We are a nonprofit law firm.
And how does something like that work?
We raise money to pay for the services that we provide at no charge to our clients.
And you're providing these services at no charge. Why? Who are your clients?
Our clients are low-income individuals who are either terminally ill or HIV positive. In some instances, we can stretch that to include someone who's in the end stage of a chronic disease.
Oh, okay.
Depending on what the doctor's willing to sign.
Ah, so if you have a doctor that's lying for you and you own a major corporation.
we do require income verification on our documents.
Ah, okay.
But hence the word hospice.
Right. The organization was really established as a joint project of the Dallas Bar Association and the then Dallas Gay Alliance, following a conference at SMU, a conference of the professions, I think is what it was called. And they had done an early, it's an interdisciplinary conference bringing folks together on a specific topic. The topic that year was the emerging crisis of AIDS. And out of that conference, the Bar Association teamed with DGA to establish what was then called Dallas Legal Hospice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you established this organization, AIDS
1989.
Crisis has been going on since 1830-something?
Well,
it feels
more or
like
less.
It. In the 1980s, this was established.
Yeah, 1989.
And the idea was to do what for these people who were...
at that time, those of us who are old enough to remember that time, it really was a crisis. Individuals didn't know they were HIV positive until they were hospitalized and near death in many cases. Mm-hmm. So the vast majority of casework in those early years was emergency estate planning, getting a will together, getting a medical power of attorney together, getting durable power of attorney, so that the individual's care could be determined in advance of the need. And frequently, people would be hospitalized and they wouldn't leave.
Well, and there was this, racked with the unknown, mm-hmm. which just ratcheted up the
right.
whole fear factor.
Right. And of course, there was fear of disclosing status because, mm-hmm. It was just, the stigma attached to the disease at that time was pretty horrific. And so people didn't want to disclose. They didn't want to engage a private attorney because of the fear involved, and many of them couldn't afford it. And many times they were already in the hospital. They couldn't get access mm-hmm. to an attorney to do this work for them.
So what your group would actually do would be to go to the hospital.
We have, from the beginning, been able to send attorneys to hospitals, care facilities, in order to facilitate the work that we do.
Well, tell us a little bit about the attorneys who are involved. Are these folks who don't work full-time for...
Well, we have two full-time attorneys on staff. We had three until the recession took a toll, but we now have two. We have always had a large number of volunteer attorneys from the community who have given their time. In the beginning, it was all volunteer. I think they had a broom closet at the DGA office, actually, is where they started when it was over on Cedar Springs.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be the DGA. It's now DGLA. After
DGLA,
the L,
right. We added the L. And so much of it, I mean, it really was get information for documents, crank them out, get a notary, get witnesses, get them signed, get them into people's hands. And they were doing hundreds of these documents a week in order to meet the need. And as I said, at that time it was all volunteer. Gradually we were able to add staff to the point that we have, you know, two full-time now. But we still rely on volunteer attorneys. They do non-emergency estate planning for us. We also have attorneys who will take specialized cases where our attorneys either don't have the expertise or we don't have the time to invest in
a
single case.
Let's talk about some of these issues that that come up now. When the organization was new, of course, all you did was end-of-life planning, which meant here's my will and here's what I want you to do with my body. And as cold and blunt as that sounds, that was basically it. People very often back in the early 80s, early mid-80s, who were diagnosed with AIDS, there was no test for it at the time when Dallas Legal Hospice, as it was called at the time, started. There was no there were no treatments for a lot of the diseases that people were contracting.
Well, yeah, the only treatment was for some of the attendant illnesses. There was no treatment for the viruses.
Well, and even some of those, like Kaposi's sarcoma, there was no treatment at the time.
There really wasn't. Not at that time.
Not at first, and they've come up with things. Now, treatable disease, manageable, not really treatable, but manageable disease. People are living longer, while the life expectancy before was maybe 10 years that you could live without getting an opportunistic infection. Now, on medication, the average lifespan they've found so far, because we've only had these drugs that are keeping people alive since about 1995, 96, 20 years, even a little bit more than that.
Well, and let me just interject. Some of the complacency about the disease has come about because of the new treatments. We still see new clients who are 20, 21, newly diagnosed, recently seroconverted, and the attitude is, well, it's treatable. This is no big deal. And I think we need to continue to get the message out there. The treatments are toxic.
And we talk about that a lot on the air when we have a guest who's involved in HIV and AIDS services, because I think the complacency out there is to say it's treatable is like, well, you pop a pill and you go about your day. No.
That's not it. And there are compounding issues at this point. Because the new medical treatments, the pharmaceutical treatments, have been around a while, there are strains of the virus that are becoming resistant to those drugs. So newly infected persons run the risk of being infected with a resistant strain of the virus, which means that the treatments aren't going to work for them. We have just got to get over this notion that it's back to life as usual, because, you know, I can live 50 years with this disease. Maybe you can. But we're already seeing individuals who have run out of treatments. The virus has mutated, and it's now resistant.
And they're saying that the average treatment will last 20 years, 21 years, something
like
in that area. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the things that people need that you help them with to get their lives in order. And these are things not just for people who are HIV positive, who have a terminal illness. It's not just for people who are low income. These are things that
everybody
needs and should have in place, because you never know when something's going to happen.
Exactly.
But these are things that especially people who are single need to have. If you're married, it's assumed that your spouse will take care of some of these things and inherit these things, and if you die without a will, for example. So what are some of the things that everybody really does need to have?
Well, everybody should have a will. Everybody should have a power of attorney for medical care and a power of attorney for financial affairs. So that there is, and you can determine when those become effective. If you have a medical power of attorney, for example, you can say, I only want this to become effective when I can't make decisions for myself anymore. You can do the same thing with financial power of attorney. So that
so those
people
are two
don't,
separate documents.
Those are two separate documents.
And you can't just combine that I want everything taken care of by...
No. You really need two separate documents. Mm-hmm. They do two separate things.
You don't need two separate people doing it. You just
you don't
need
have
two
to.
Separate documents.
Yeah, most people will use the same agent, primary agent. You also want to be sure that you have a secondary agent in case the primary is not available to step in. People who are in a relationship that's not legally recognized, regardless of whether same gender or opposite gender couples, you should have an appointment of agent for disposition of remains so that your wishes about what you want done with your body upon your death are carried out by someone you trust.
Now, what happens if somebody has all of these documents in place? Let's say we had an odd relationship, and Patty and I had those documents in place for each other. Mm-hmm. And if something happens to one of us, you know, she's a lot older than I am, so, and actually Patty's on the phone right now, so I can say these things about Patty is a lot older than I, so something happens to Patty, and then her family comes in and says, no, we don't want that to happen. What happens? What takes precedence if I have all of these documents?
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I can't speak to legal advice. But the way the system is supposed to work is the agents named in the documents have the authority. And that's one of the reasons you want the documents, is so that you get to decide who makes these decisions. Then you also want to be sure that your agents understand what your wishes are in these matters.
Okay, so let's take a medical power of attorney. Mm-hmm. I have the medical power of attorney for Patty. She's rushed to the hospital. She has to do something. Something needs approval. And I walk in, and they say, well, who are you? Do I actually have to have that piece of paper with me?
You must have the document with you.
If you're a married couple and you present yourself as a married couple, because, if Patty and I were to go to Baylor, they might assume that she and I were married. Would they even question in most cases?
I don't know that. Okay. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, so, but if you aren't married, if you have the medical power of attorney, that paper needs to be pretty available with you.
It does.
If you're traveling, and this would apply, I guess, to even a same-sex couple from Massachusetts who is married, they're traveling and traveling across country, and they're in Texas. Texas doesn't recognize those relationships. Would you even recommend that they carry papers like this too?
You know,
again, this is legal.
Yeah,
this is a legal question, and you're not an attorney.
I'm not, and I think it's better to be safe in those instances. If
you're in a place
where
they don't recognize the relationship, that really, you're expecting, well, we're married, we have our documents here.
Yeah.
A heterosexual couple doesn't carry their marriage licenses with them, but maybe a straight couple or a same-sex couple that is traveling, if they just have with them, and they shouldn't, isn't that an odd thing
that
nobody thinks of carrying with them?
Yeah.
I have to admit,
it had not occurred to me.
Yeah. So you have a medical power of attorney, you have a financial power. What does the financial power of attorney do?
That really allows you to act as the person in all issues related to banking, loans, credit cards. You can buy and sell stocks, you can buy and sell real estate if the power of attorney is effective.
And that's before the person dies?
It can be. Yes, it would end at the time of the death of the individual. The agent is only able to act on behalf of the individual while they're alive, but unable to make those decisions.
So, okay, if I have the medical power of attorney on my much older friend, Patty Fink, and this would kick in, does it say when it kicks in?
You can designate on the form whether it takes effect upon signing or whether it takes effect on her inability to act.
Okay, so it would be in my interest then, if I want to take over her financial control, to make sure that she is still alive and yet incapacitated.
And I would require you, of course, to pay all my bills on time.
Right. Yeah, well, if you're incapacitated, there's no way for you to know that. So
right.
You want to be sure that the agent that you appoint is someone who's going to really act
trust.
In your best interest.
Oh, somebody that you trust. Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, it won't be David.
We got that. Okay, we skipped that whole point right there. Okay, what are the other ones? The disposition of remains.
The disposition of remains is a document that you would present at the funeral home that allows you to make decisions about.
And why would there be a question there? What is the question?
The question is, if you are in a relationship that's not recognized legally, the funeral home is going to tend to turn to a direct family member for those directions. And that would be mother, father, husband, wife, son, daughter.
They would
take precedent in the decision. If you don't have that document, they would take precedent in the decision-making over an unrelated, unrecognized partner.
And that's all about it, because the Texas law, when we say a direct relative, if you were married, then you would be that direct relative, but Texas doesn't even see us.
Right.
So we're not there.
Okay. We're not there yet.
Yeah, you're not there. Why doesn't all of that go into the will?
Well, the will is generally not read immediately upon the death of an individual, so you wouldn't know what the wishes were in a timely fashion.
The will is actually usually read after the funeral, normally.
Many times a will doesn't need to be probated, and so nobody outside people named in the will would see it.
Mm-hmm.
But our clients specifically, who are all low-income clients, don't have estates, so to speak. They do, but they don't have them in the way we think of them. Some of them might have a house. Most of them are really making gifts of personal possessions to people who are important to them. Beyond that, any decision that needs to be made needs to be stated outside the will.
And those decisions, and we're going to take a break in a second, decisions have to do with medical care, financial care, disposition of remains. Mm-hmm. Anything else that I'm missing? Those are the main ones.
Those really are the main ones.
Yeah. Why don't we take our break? We're talking to Roger Waddell. He is the executive director of the Legal Hospice of Texas. It's located right here in Oak Lawn, but they serve a much wider area of North Texas. We'll give out some contact information and some more information about the types of things that Legal Hospice of Texas does right after this break.
If your garage is getting a little cramped for space, upsize it by moving out that old car you don't need anymore. The KNON Vehicle Donation Program is here to take your old car, truck, or motorcycle that's cluttering your garage. Just call 877-KNON-AUTO or go online at knon.org to make your donation. Our representative will come out, pick up your vehicle, and leave you with a cleaner garage. They'll handle the paperwork, and most importantly, your donation will go to support great community radio. The number to call is 877-KNON-AUTO or donate online at knon.org.
Red Red Hot and Blue presents the second annual K&O-N Fort Worth Blues Fest at the Keys Lounge, 5677 West Creek Drive. This is Blue Lisa inviting you to join us Saturday, March 19th and Sunday, March 20th for Hot Texas Blues right in your backyard. Doors for both days are 3 p.m. This year's all-star lineup features Holland K. Smith, Jackie Don Lowe, James Hinkle, the Bruton Prize Swingmaster Review, Paul Bird, Trainwreck featuring K.M. Williams and Washboard Jackson, Cheryl Arena, Chris Salez, Kent Viceroy and the Super Kings, the Bulldogs, Aaron Burton, the Rob Donovan Band, the Paul Harrington Band, Tone Summer and Gonzi Trevino, and the Mike Johnson Band. We will be selling delicious barbecue from Red Hot and Blue. Advance tickets are available now for only $10 per day at knowin.org, all Red Hot and Blue restaurants, Record Town in Fort Worth, Bill's Records in Dallas, Forever Young Records in Grand Prairie, and at the Keys Lounge. So come join KNOWN for the second annual Fort Worth Blues Fest, Saturday, March 19th and Sunday, March 20th at the Keys Lounge in Fort Worth, sponsored by Red Hot and Blue, catering with a Southern accent.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly, Drive Time Edition. I'm Dave Taffet, and I'm here in the studio with Patty Fink. This is our second, and Patty, how our second Drive Time show, our 1,432nd show, something like that, on KNON. I did a quick count, and that was the number I came up with, number of shows that we've done. We've been a Sunday show for years and years, just got moved to Drive Time on Wednesdays.
And we've been on the air, actually, since KNON's been on the air.
Yeah, yeah.
In 1983.
There are about five or six shows that date back to the original.
Yeah.
And we are one of those. When the station first went on the air part-time in August of 83, we were one of those. But
The last time I was on the show, you were still over in the old house.
The crack house.
Yeah, we openly call it the crack house.
The crack house.
In East Dallas.
Yes. But now we have very nice studios
here in
Oklahoma.
We don't have any pigeons to welcome you. I'm sorry.
Oh, I knew there was something I was missing.
But the old studio was plagued with pigeons that would walk around on the little air conditioning unit, and you could hear the on the mics because the mics were close enough to the windows. And no, we have lovely studios now, and we're very proud of them. We're talking to Roger Waddell. He is the executive director of the Legal Hospice of Texas. We're talking about just some of the documents that you actually need. And we're going to go on to several other issues. But
just to be sure, people need to consult with an attorney to be sure that in their specific situation they have the documents they need. We're talking in generalities here about some of the standard documents. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not giving advice other than find somebody who can give you the advice that fits your situation.
Right, and talking about some of the situations that might come up. Yeah.
Well, I think we were talking earlier about this, you know, by the time a person does invoke a will and they've passed away, that they oftentimes don't have a lot of possessions. And I think it's a reality in our society today that if you were in a health crisis, which any of those situations might that would bring you a client would be, that oftentimes you end up losing anything that you've accumulated, whether that be cash or property or whatever, over time as you access more and more services.
Right.
And you know, I can guess that would be a common thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, our clients have to hit income cap guidelines. For our HIV clients, and this is part of the reason it gets complicated, is the funding streams dictate a lot of what we're able to do. Our original 12 counties of service, through government contracts, we can see HIV-positive clients who earn up to 300% of the federal poverty line, which for a single person is around $33,000 a year.
And that's the three times.
That's the three times. Now, outside in the four counties to the west, Tarrant, Parker, Johnson, and Hood, and for all of our non-HIV positive clients, the income cap is 125% of federal poverty level, which is about $11,000 a year.
Wow.
So the folks who actually qualify for our services are already on the fringe of economic stability.
If they had, you know, had some property and cash and such, it's gone by the time you see them.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of what we're talking about, though, things like the powers of attorney, everybody needs those.
Everybody needs those. Right. Right.
There are a lot of online do-it-yourself kits, and from what I've heard, those generally work. Again, not legal advice, but it doesn't hurt. Even if you want to do those, show them to an attorney.
Because especially family law, and this all falls under family law. Family law varies state by state. So you want to be sure that any document you take offline or you go buy at an office supply store applies to the state that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
And also pay attention when a document needs to be notarized.
Right.
That's a real easy one to skip, and if it's not notarized, it doesn't take effect. Doesn't take effect. In these powers of attorney, I know that you're doing, you're helping the person while they're alive mm-hmm. at the point at which the person, and you're only representing that person.
Right.
You are not representing his family or,
right.
and by his family, I mean the people that he or she has designated as family. Have you heard anecdotally that most of what you've done actually is working for them?
Well, yeah, the feedback we get from individual, and occasionally we will get a call from someone who's an agent on a document for a client who's deceased. They just want to know, basically, now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And we get feedback from folks that, yes, they were happy to have this in place. They were glad it was in place. We cannot offer, we can't represent them in any way. We can't really give them legal advice because our relationship was with the client mm-hmm. only.
And
we can explain processes to them.
Okay. And you can refer them to somebody who can
right.
help them. So.
Right.
Here's really what my question is. Are you getting the feedback that in most cases, because you're working generally with non-traditional families, although not in all cases. Lots of people who are married have HIV. Lots of people who are married and in traditional family situations, and they just want their documents also.
Sure.
But more than the usual law firm, yours is dealing with a lot of people who are in non-traditional families. You're getting the feedback that it's working and that in Texas, people like I would never make a political statement. Our stupid attorney general is challenging any of that.
Not that I'm aware
not
of.
Okay.
No, I don't. We don't hear any of that. And in fact, I'm in my 11th year at the hospice, and when I first went there, we did have funeral homes who would challenge the appointment of an agent for disposition of remains and would just ignore it and go to a family member. We don't hear much about that anymore. People are really accustomed to dealing with the documents. And most people in professions are now accustomed to dealing with folks in non-traditional family arrangements.
Now, take somebody like me. I don't think my situation is that unusual, but it is more unusual than most. My closest relative would be a first cousin.
That Texas would recognize?
That Texas would recognize. I don't have, my parents are gone. I don't have children, not legally married. So closest relative would be a first cousin or an aunt and an uncle. Who does a funeral home go to in cases like that even?
I do not know.
You don't even know.
No.
You're saying that now, lately, you haven't heard, that when you started, you heard more.
Mm-hmm.
I have an instance happened 20 years ago when my first partner died. His parents, who were very supportive, but they were not the people named in the powers of attorney. For real practical reasons, his mother was very loving. They were very close. She was not a caregiver. And what John wanted everybody to know was that, and John and I were not together at the time, but that his current partner and I, but mostly me because Luis was not the best caregiver either, were to make the actual decisions. And the reason for that was simply we would make the most responsible decisions. And the point was not mm-hmm. to cut out anybody mm-hmm. else. It was just for...
And that's the wisest thing to do. You want to put an agent who's going to actually function in your best interest and will be close enough in proximity to be able to function in those instances.
So 2 weeks before John died, his parents took us to court so that they could have... so that they could take control of who made the medical decisions. We were in Georgia at the time. So we're in front of a judge in Georgia in late 1980s. Can you imagine? The judge actually made a very good decision. He turned to both sides and said, can you make joint decisions? And I said yes. Luis said no. The parents, well, they were getting something, so they said yes. I kicked Luis under the table. I said, trust me on this. And we came to that decision, and so we decided to make joint. We ended up, now, I knew his mother had no patience for any of this. She was there and would come to the hospital, visit for half an hour, go out, come back, visit for an hour, go out. David, do you need time to go? Yes, I want to go get some dinner. Okay. And then she would go out, and I would be there for 12 hours at a time. So, because I was more the caregiver, and it wasn't a matter of who loved who more. I mean, I'm not in any way suggesting that. So his mother calls up. We make this decision. We're in court. His mother comes back, and she said, okay, we have a decision to make. She was so excited she had a decision to make. It was just before Christmas. On Christmas Day, we can only get a male nurse. Is that okay? I told him that I thought it was, but I wanted your input on this. Luis looks at me. I said, that's a very good decision. You go tell them. She made the decision. She left. We didn't hear from her till the funeral. After taking us to court on that kind of thing. But you're really not hearing that when there are these powers of attorney in place that people are being challenged on them in stupid ways.
I'm not hearing that. If those are happening, it would be more likely that one of our attorneys would hear happening. But I don't hear it.
So we were talking earlier about the attorneys that volunteer their time mm-hmm. pro bono mm-hmm. for clients at your organization. How do you go about getting them, or dare I say the word recruit? Randy, recruit these attorneys.
We don't have to recruit, actually. Word of mouth gets us a pretty steady, ongoing influx of new pro bono attorneys. Our real issue is that we don't have enough cases for them at any one time. So we try to make sure that each attorney gets at least one case a year, and so we rotate through the list. But our non-emergency estate planning cases, I think last year we had a total of 119 cases that were handled by pro bono attorneys during the year, which is a lot of cases. We closed 663 cases last year, so about 119, 120 were done by community volunteer attorneys.
And clearly they're attorneys and not lawyers. So I make a distinction.
You do?
I do, absolutely.
Okay.
An attorney does good things for good people for good reasons. An attorney makes money. A lawyer makes money.
Well, we have pro bono attorneys. and we also have, for example, for the other cases that we really don't have the resources to do, or they fall outside our areas of practice. We had a very complex case come to us last year that included employment law, insurance. There were three issues, and I can't remember now what they were. And they kind of all coalesced into this one person's life. And we were able to find one of the large firms in town, Hunton and Williams, took the case, and they stayed with it. It was almost a year-long case. Mm. and got it resolved in favor of the client, who now doesn't any longer qualify for our services.
because
it's a great outcome. So we're able to get a lot of support from the legal community in the town.
Do you still work closely with the Dallas Bar Association?
Not as close as we did, though. I mean, most of our pro bono attorneys are members of the Dallas Bar.
Well, let's talk about, you mentioned employment. Mm-hmm. Kids. What kinds of employment issues would be coming up with somebody who is HIV positive, and because these are who you deal with, low mm-hmm. income, terminally ill? Who are these, or what are these employment issues?
Well, the issues for HIV positive individuals primarily would fall under the Americans with Disabilities Act for accommodations. As long as you can really continue to perform your job, and again, from an outsider's perspective, non-attorney perspective, if you need an accommodation to continue your job, whether that's time off to take your medicine or time off for a doctor's appointment or some really minor adjustment to your schedule, that's negotiable under the ADA.
When you say time off to take your medication, here we're going back to what we were talking about at the very beginning of the show when, Patty, you said, well, it's more than just, it is a lifestyle adjustment.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to take 15 minutes, take the pill, sit down for a few minutes.
Yeah.
To let it set so that you don't get up and you're nauseous.
Right. So, I mean, those are the kinds of accommodations. And most of the time, again, the change has been from a hostile work environment to a work environment where employers, usually middle management folks, just don't understand what the law says. Mm-hmm. And it just takes educating them. And most of the time, we're able to get that accommodation made. But the key is you really have to be able to continue to do your job.
Right.
If you can't do, if you can't do your job, that's not an accommodation.
The employer doesn't owe you the job that you can't do.
Yeah, that you can't do.
Is it under the law? And again, maybe this is too legal. There's a variety of jobs out there in this one work group that the person's in. He can't do his job, but he could still work. Do they?
I don't. That's specific legal advice, and that is part of the law. I don't know.
But that is something to discuss with an attorney. Then possibility of moving you within the company, if that's company policy.
A company that large is probably going to have an HR department that is well versed in the ADA.
So mostly,
it would be
what you're
something,
dealing with,
something you would want to go to an HR department.
So mostly, what you're dealing with then are people in a smaller company.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, I can't remember now whether it's 12 or 15 employees mm-hmm. that falls under the federal ADA. So, it's a smaller company.
Smaller companies. And if you're that small that you're fewer than, say, 12 people, then you don't even count for this, and your employer doesn't have to.
That's correct.
Part of the ADA also is physical accommodations in a building. Like if you're suddenly wheelchair bound, you should be able to get in. Are you dealing with those kinds of complaints or not?
We really don't have, not that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. So those are more the kinds of things that you would refer where to the city, even because those are zoning.
The specific issues. Most public buildings now have to be accessible, wheelchair mm-hmm. accessible. So,
David,
outside my purview.
Yes, he's 4'8". He's jumped over that fence into another area there.
Yeah. Well, we're talking to Roger Waddell. He is from Texas. He is from Legal Hospice of Texas. Your name used to be Dallas Legal Hospice.
It flows
off the tongue a whole lot.
Till 2007.
Legal Hospice of Texas. We're going to be back. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
Do you need free help with your taxes? I'm State Senator Royce West to tell you about United Way's free tax preparation services. IRS-certified tax preparers will ensure individuals or families who earned less than $50,000 last year receive the highest refund possible. Sites open through April in convenient locations. They're open days, evenings, and weekends. To locate the free United Way tax preparation site near you, simply dial 211. Thank you.
KNON is proud to present another KNON Barbecue and Blues Benefit event on Sunday, March 27th at The Bone in Deep Ellum, featuring the blues stylings of Andrea Dawson and Carrie Lee Pye, with special guests Mr. Andrew Jr. Boy Jones backing up these two fine blues divas. Mama Faye's Barbecue and Home Cooked Food will be serving up delicious barbecue plates with hot links, brisket, chicken, ribs, and sides. This is an early event with the doors at 5 p.m. and the music starting at 6. Tickets available now for $8 at KNON.org, Bill's Records in Dallas, Forever Young Records in Grand Prairie, or at The Bone, located at 2724 Elm Street in Deep Ellum. Just look for the big KNON painted on the side of the building. That's Barbecue and Blues, Sunday, March 27th, beginning at 5 p.m. at The Bone, with Andrea Dawson, Carrie Lee Pye, Andrew Junior Boy Jones, and complimentary barbecue plates from Mama Faye's.
Listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
It's time for
Those Darn Heterosexuals. In a recent report, Tennessee is the second fattest state in the country. The heterosexuals concerned with budget reform will pay for Medicaid recipients to have bariatric surgery, but will not pay for one visit to a dietitian.
Talk about your defense of marriage. A Roman Catholic Church tribunal in Italy ruled that a heterosexual marriage should be annulled on the grounds of the wife's adultery, even though she only thought about having an affair.
And our heterosexual criminals of the week are five men from Silver Spring Shores, Florida. The group broke into a house and a number of items, including what they thought was a stash of cocaine, was taken. They told the police they had used some of it. Turned out it was the ashes of the father of the person whose house they broke into. That's this week's
Those Darn Heterosexuals.
One other issue that you deal with, Roger. Roger Waddell is with the Legal Hospice of Texas. One of the other issues, and again, Roger is not an attorney. He's not giving legal advice here at all. We're just talking about the types of issues that people need to watch for. That has to do with COBRA, healthcare coverage, that kind of thing.
Just generally insurance.
Insurance coverage.
It's a big bucket.
So tell us, how is Obamacare going to destroy this country, and how is our president a socialist?
The short answer is, at this point, we don't know. What we do know is that the regulations that will institutionalize the Health Care Reform Act will be rolled out over a period of years. And so we don't really know what those regulations are going to be. It's really impossible right now to even speculate what the individual impact would be for one person.
So all this stuff that everybody's against, they don't know what they're against because the regulations actually haven't been written yet.
Yes, I mean, the fear factor is the unknown. Mm-hmm. What we do know from national polling is that as the first parts of the Health Care Reform Act have been implemented, the resistance decreases. And I think the last poll I saw, the positive polling for Health Care Reform Act is now over 50%.
So the major things that have come through, things like insurance companies can't discriminate against people with
pre-existing conditions.
Parents can keep their children on their policies until the age of 26. So more people are being covered, and quite a few of them at a lower cost. Mm-hmm. So people aren't objecting to those things.
Apparently. Looking at the polling data, it suggests that as people really find out what the act is bringing about the results. That's not so bad. You know, and ultimately, the goal is that every American should have access to health care. That's a pretty worthy goal, since we have a pretty abysmal track record in that arena in industrialized Western nations.
Yeah, and one thing that's surprising is actually in Dallas County, we're pretty good, because Parkland does take care of quite a few who just wouldn't have
access.
Well,
and I think Dallas County citizens need to be applauded for maintaining a public health hospital. Many counties,
but building a whole new one right now. They just started work this week, or the frame just started going up on the new hospital.
But many counties, rather than put in place the financial resources to maintain county hospitals, just closed them in the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, in this area, there's John Peter Smith and there's Parkland. Those are the Tarrant County and Dallas County are the only two county-supported hospitals.
And
I think the counties really need to be applauded for that.
And people who can't afford in surrounding counties get dumped into Dallas and Tarrant.
Oh, sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Certainly, when I lived in West Texas, I worked at a hospital that was not the county hospital, but we served a 17-county area.
Mm.
That's how many counties out in, you know, far West Texas.
Right. And the counties there are actually larger than the counties here.
Oh, span hundreds and hundreds of square miles.
Yeah.
But it is an important one.
Yeah.
So what types of things are people coming to Legal Hospice of Texas about?
Well, one of the really growing areas for us is public benefits. Just clarification on who qualifies for Medicaid, who qualifies for Medicare, what are the different parts of Social Security that might cover you, disability, supplemental. And I put together interesting to us, maybe not to anybody else. But last year, in 2010, our total expense budget for the year was $400,500. And in that year, we recovered back awards, either in benefits of some kind, unemployment or Social Security or long-term disability benefits, of $257,100. And we initiated monthly going forward benefits of $29,605. So if you per month, if you do that on an annual figure, on our $400,000 budget, we generated $612,000 on behalf of our clients.
That's tremendous.
So for every dollar that donors invest in us, we not only get positive outcomes legally, we get positive outcomes in supporting the very lives of our clients.
And that is in addition to all of the paperwork and other stuff that you're doing for them.
Right.
And getting done.
It's not just the legal decision. Yeah. It's the financial benefit that actually comes to clients.
Good. Now, I know you're also an activist in our community for many years, and I'm just going to veer off our topic really quick to hit something that happened in the last week, and that is this Supreme Court decision favoring Westboro Baptist Church,
right?
Against being able, they're basically saying they have every right to protest at
in public,
funerals. Right? In public,
areas, yeah.
To protest against military funerals, and we in the GLBT community have been very familiar with Westboro Baptist Church now for decades. And
these are the Fred Phelps people.
Right.
Might know them by that name.
With the very orange, green, yellow combo signs. And so we've seen them. What is your take on that decision, and what do you think it means for our community?
Well, my personal take on that is I think it was the right decision. And I haven't read the opinion, the majority opinion, but what I gather from reports is I think it, just because we don't agree with the speech doesn't mean it's not protected speech. And the court established decades ago that there is speech that's not protected. Like, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater when there's no fire. I mean, you can't generate panic that becomes dangerous to people. Those folks are despicable, mm-hmm. disgusting. They warp faith into a hate message that I think is absolutely foreign to the tradition that they claim.
And you say,
but
this
it is protected.
And you say that actually from a from another place of experience. Well,
yeah.
You're one of those Rebders.
Yeah, I am a
Reverend
Rebder.
Dr. Roger Waddell.
So, yeah. My role as clergy is horrified at the way they pervert religion, mm-hmm. and particularly the Christian faith, into a weapon of destruction mm-hmm. and pain that I think is contrary to Scripture.
And you know, one thing I thought was interesting about this decision, Alito, who is the one person who mm-hmm. dissented, his dissent, usually a dissent is you have some people on one side of the issue, some people on the other side of the issue, and the difference between the two was the eight set the bar all the way up here, and Alito set it about 1 inch lower, and the difference between the two is where Westboro fell. Hmm. Alito's decision is certainly not, we need to shut these people up, we need to tell... He was really saying, you know, in the instance of a funeral, we have the right to tell certain people, because certain speech is not protected, we have the right to tell some people for a short period of time to shut up. And he didn't say it that way, but I think...
That's basically what he said.
I think really yeah. that's what he was saying, that their speech is protected, they can say these things, they don't need to say it during the funeral of this guy.
In this place, in this moment, for this period
right.
of time.
Right. Right. And that's about all that he was saying. You know, while I get the decision of the eight, here's what worries me about it. I was in Austin this week, as was your partner, Erin Penny. I was covering it. She was doing some lobbying. People were down in Austin on Monday lobbying for the anti-bullying bill, among other things, but that was one of the things. It really worries me that using that 8-1 decision, that bullies can then use this decision and say, but my bullying is protected speech.
Well, but there again, the court has already established that speech that incites harm is not protected. And the dividing line is that the Westboro folks, while their signs are wretched, they're not inciting action. That's harmful to anyone. What they're calling for is a change in the law mm-hmm. to reflect their very narrow perspective.
Well, and I think, too, in Westboro's case, if you're mourning the loss of a loved one, whether that be a friend or a family member, and these people are outside protesting, and what you feel is anger, sadness,
sure.
Rage, you know, that sort of thing, but it's not, it's really not inviting you to go attack them. It's mm-hmm. just that they're there and you don't want to mm-hmm. see them right now.
Right.
That's really the bottom
right.
line. Whereas a bully can, you know, escalate so quickly and over a sustained chronic period of time that
does
can
harm.
Become acute that does do harm.
Right.
And I'm hoping that, you know, like I've seen this decision, that 1 inch of difference between Alito and the eight, that bullying is more on Alito's side, and really is one of those yelling fire things,
yeah.
that you are inciting the harm, and that those eight were really seeing that there was actually no harm, but in the case of bullying, there is harm. I'm just worried that with this legislation, that the bully is going to be able to go out there and say, no, all I'm doing is I'm calling him a name, and I have the right to do that.
Well, and you know, our system works. It takes time for the system to work,
mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, many times those decisions come at the expense of individual pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think our community, the GLBT community, as opposed to many military families and such, have become so jaded and used to Westboro Baptist Church that we turn it into fundraising.
Right.
Whenever he comes around and his family. And at some point, it's going to happen long enough that people say, hey, we need to make this into, turn this into a positive.
Right.
And the longer he's out there, you know, for every minute he's out there, I'm giving $10 to this organization that's going to do some good in my community.
Which we did the last time he was here.
Right.
We had a goal of raising $3,000. We raised $11,000, gave it to the AIDS Resource Center. And
they got an ice machine.
And they got a new ice machine and other equipment that they needed. I personally wrote a thank you note to Westboro, sent them a picture of the new ice machine, asked them when they're coming back, and said...
Because the parking lot needs paving.
I listed some other things we needed. And do you know, for the first time, they haven't been back in almost a year, because those people are normally in Dallas. But if they know that what they're doing is going to actually help other people, they won't show up again. So actually, our method of getting rid of them was better than their own method. We need to get going. Roger, I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Can
I just say... What keeps us going is donor support. We have an event coming up, March 24th. It is our fifth annual Fashion Cited Fashion Show. It's at Mark Events, 1130 Dragon Street. You can get more information about that and the work we do and how you can volunteer at www.legalhospice.org.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Roger.
I also want to thank you for jumping in pretty much last minute. Our guests today were supposed to be Larry and Casey Jansen. They'll be here next week. They were my Valentine's couple that I wrote about. They met in reparative therapy fell in love. And because reparative therapy didn't repair anything, it wasn't therapy, they are together. Do you want to know why they're not here today? They're doing Oprah.
All right.
So our guests will be our guests Larry and Casey.
We get the after Oprah.
After Oprah. You know what can you do?
Aww.
And we'll be back next week with more Lambda Weekly. Again, thanks Roger for being here.
Thank you for listening to the KNON Morning Line. We'd like to remind you that the views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KNON 89.3 FM.